And then this morning, if you want more receipts on that, how about this morning?
Okay, this is it right here. This is why we're talking right here. Go ahead.
You want another receipt? I got one for you.
Yeah, tell me.
Best news of the day. American advisors are in Belarus talking about, you know, coordinating, yeah, military, you know, exercises. While the Germans and the French are moving tanks into Poland.
Right.
Right. Like here. Let me get the actual thing so that we're not weird. Okay. The actual thing. U.S. military officers attend Russia-Belarus war games. Okay. How this has not happened since the beginning of the Cold War. Okay.
Right.
This is a major, major thing. And then here's your next.
Tom, this is amazing.
Then your next receipt. Ready? Yeah. And everybody's getting it wrong because everybody wants to hate the United States because everybody in the commentariat, well, has shown us who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Trump comes out and he says,
Tom Luongo, Gold, Goats, and Guns. Good afternoon to you, my friend. How are you?
I'm good, Andy. How are you? How are you holding up?
You know, I am good. I am good. I guess, but also confused.
Mm-hmm.
Also trying to connect dots and trying to work things out. And that's why I'm talking to you. And that's also why on the record, you're one of my favorite guests. You really are.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. And you connect those really well for me typically. Mm-hmm. And also I love how you gamify everything. And that is not a disrespectful way to put things.
When I'm not being a complete and utter, you know, screaming asshole, but yeah, I'm good.
You're not to me. So that's all I care about.
Fair. Yeah. I do attenuate based on the situation. So, you know, what are you going to do? But there you go. All right.
You're very gracious to me, but we had an event obviously that's got mm-hmm. the, it's just in the news cycle, for lack of a better way to say it. And it's something very important with Charlie Kirk. Can you start working that out for me? What is going on and what's happening and how do you see this thing?
Sure. First things first, obviously, you know, this is an unacceptable level of political violence, right? We can't, and I'm going to make it abundantly clear, folks, we can't live like this anymore. And moreover, we will not. This is what we have to pledge to ourselves when we go to bed at night. Like, we're done pleading and we're done negotiating. Okay. We're not asking, you know, hey man, we shouldn't live like this anymore. No. We will not live like this anymore. And I think it's very important that we frame it in that context, because otherwise that leaves open the possibility of negotiation or pleading or leaving them with the power to just, no. You have now invalidated everything about who you are and what you are. And you don't get to be a part of civil society until you fully and utterly and honestly, truly repudiate what happened. Period. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm sorry. I don't care how angry you are in the moment. I don't care, you know, and there's a lot of people out there who are, you know, twerking on TikTok because they were allowing themselves a moment of even if they, you know, had a moment of temporary insanity or whatever you want to call it. I don't care. Like, it doesn't matter. To me, this is mask off kind of moment, right? And you have to treat it that way. You don't have to get like insanely angry about it. You don't have to get histrionic about it. You don't have to do any of that. You just have to say, look, this is it. We're done. And that's it. Shut up. Mm-hmm. And no, little terrier, you're going to stop kicking. I'm going to stand here with my hand on your chest until you submit to the will of something. And if you can't do that, well, then you're going to suffer the consequences of that. And the first phase of that, of course, is that you lose your job, you get removed and shunned from polite society. And we have to start there and start making examples of people and getting them to understand that this is not an acceptable way to organize. You know, this is not a valid organizing principle for society, period. So, because, you know, that was not what Charlie Kirk was doing. He was doing the exact opposite of that. And, you know, you told us that, you know, if you didn't like the censorship on Twitter to go build our own, then we did two or three times. And then you got rid of them. You said, you can't do that. Obama told us we didn't build anything without, you know, him, you know, all of that. And now, okay, we got to be peaceful about it. Okay, we were peaceful. Charlie Kirk went on college campus after college campus after college campus and just chatted with people, being as generous as of spirit as he could be, given the level of opprobrium that he got and the level of, frankly, you know, insanity that he got from people. Clip after clip after clip after clip that's out there of him. And, you know, and I, for years, hadn't given Charlie really one second thought. Because, you know, look, I'm out on the tip of the iceberg trying to figure out, you know, where we're going or where we're headed. And, you know, Charlie was, you know, got the working in the middle of the room. And it's a different, you know, we had different focuses, right? And your focus determines your reality. And so I didn't really quite grok just how big he had become. And so in light of that, and in light of what I've seen since then, and then going and spending the last 4 or 5 days reviewing where he had gotten to, I'm like, yeah, dude, you were on the side of, you're on the right path. You know, If I wish I was that hip at 31 years old, I wish I was as awakened as that at 31 years old. I didn't have my political awakening until I was 32 or 33. I'm dead serious. Like Charlie Kirk's life ended when my current life began, you know, in terms of age. So I think about it now, right? I didn't even realize that the guy was only 31 years old. I didn't realize that he started Turning Point when he was 18. I didn't realize any of this stuff, right? So what we have to realize now is that statement that I just made, which is now clearly being catching like wildfire across the entire space, where we watch the memetic collapse occur across millions of people, not just in America, but around the world, about what actually just transpired. We may have been horrified by Luigi Mangione, but, you know, what happened to Charlie Kirk was unconscionable because it happened live on television. You know, it was caught and immediately disseminated. And what did he do? He just started to talk to people about, you know, the way he saw the world and the way they saw the world. Let's come through a dialogue and an arrangement. And for a long, long time, the entirety of our political discourse has been for people who are all hived off thanks to the algorithms and their own versions of their own echo chambers. We just watched those echo chambers be blasted apart. Right. So the far left lived in their echo chamber. The far right lived in, technically, the far right lived in their echo chamber. I have my little echo chamber portion of the internet that the algorithms feed me on a regular basis. And we all have this problem, this natural curation of only seeing the things that we like to click on as opposed to the things we don't like to click on. And that is what has driven these silos, kind of cultural silos. And then you have an entire group of people, a young generation of people on nominally on the disenfranchised portion of what we would call the Zoomers, who, you know, completely ignored social media of the traditional type and, you know, retreated into gaming culture, Discord, that world. I have experience with this. My daughter is one of those. And I've celebrated the fact that she doesn't even have a Twitter account. I've celebrated the fact that she hasn't been, you know, conditioned by that form of the mind virus. And then when I sit down and chat with her about where, you know, what the internet is and what the information space looks like, his very sophisticated view of the, and probably an overly cynical view of the level of fakery and the level of nonsense that's out there. And, but that's okay. Like her bullshit meter, for lack of a better term, is pretty finely tuned. It's probably overtuned, to be honest with you, the more I chat with her about these things, but that's between she and I. That's a natural give and take within, relationship between a father and, his soon to be 20 something daughter, especially in this environment. But I get glimpses into it on a regular basis. And I get to tip my toes into that culture every once in a while because I can speak that language, at least to a smaller extent, because I'm an old school gamer. Now, that being said, all of those subcultures come together now in the version of the story that we're being told about the death of Charlie Kirk. Now, I'm not going to be here and spin out a whole bunch of different scenarios about what I think happened, because I don't think it matters. As of right now, the dominant story that they're promulgating to us, which is probably the most obvious and most likely, is that this kid was radicalized at a certain level. He had already been, there was a whole series of, in some ways now, that as the information comes out, red flags. Those red flags could be post hoc psyops. They could be any number of things. They could be covering for the real shooter or the real, whatever. I don't care. None of that matters, because the reality is that everything that's been presented to us is already enough overwhelming evidence that we have a fundamental fucking problem that needs to be dealt with, even if it's not true. Okay? This is an important, very important point I need to make. And I've been trying to make to people on Twitter and within my community and whatnot, which is that it doesn't matter whether this is true or not. It doesn't matter whether the kid actually pulled the trigger or any of the quote unquote holes in the story. We're now so far away from Charlie Kirk being killed that the intelligence agency slop of fake information and scene dressing and all the rest of it, it's already, we have so much malice and disinformation seeded into this for the purposes of either covering for the real story or wanting to drive division and wanting to drive a narrative and an agenda, that the truth is irrelevant now. What matters now is understanding, okay, who was this kid? And then watching who is trying to profit off of and trying to profit off of what has occurred here. And I can tell you right now that both sides, the extreme Trantifa left and the extreme accelerationist great right, are both been activated, have both been activated completely in order to try and keep the mimetic collapse of the overworked, uninterested in politics normies who just got woken up to, oh my God, we can have political violence of this type and kind in the United States. Those people are all going to shift right, nominally, or at least shift towards Donald Trump, who's really hard to call right, Donald Trump a right winger when, he looks like he's to the left of JFK, for Christ's sake, in terms of practical politics. Now, again, false dyads, false equivalences, false opposites, all of that stuff is everywhere within this conversation and everywhere within our political zeitgeist at this point, all with the purpose, of course, of trying to accelerate a collapse of the institutions, a collapse of the United States, a collapse of our government, a collapse of civil discourse, a collapse, a collapse, a collapse, a collapse. I've been screaming for years, not the chuckle and collapsitarian. I've been screaming for years, don't become the Fremen. I've been screaming for years, all of these things, every bit of it. Why? Because I could see that at some point we were going to get to a flashpoint. And all of these different disparate threads of what happens when you hive a bunch of people off into their own echo chambers meet and explode. Okay. So we're not going to solve this problem today or tomorrow or next week or even within Trump's term. What we're going to do is tear down the system that created it and leave it to the next generations to fix, because that's not our job now. Our job now is to figure out, how do we deal with the problem? How do we excise this cancer on both the extreme, because on the revolutionary left and right, at the end of the day, when you stop thinking in terms of left and right, and you start thinking in terms of power versus the people, right? A different axis. When what you have is power trying to manipulate the people to shake the ants in the ant jar, shake them up and have them fight so the power can continue while we kill each other off and we fight amongst ourselves. But what we as the people have to do is set boundaries. And we've been told for a long time that boundaries are evil, that boundaries are racist, that boundaries are this, that gender is that, blah, blah, blah. No, none of that is true. But the extreme opposite is also not true either. I've been saying for a long time, it's funny, the first time I ever sat down to chat on my podcast with my now good friend Joaquin Flores, you know, one of the few people on this planet who's I feel is a truly, I hate to bust my hand pat on myself on that, but someone I look up to in terms of their ability to see through the psyop. Joaquin comes from a leftist background. Joaquin used to be a trade unionist Marxist. I used to be a hardcore anarcho-libertarian. And both of us, we did a podcast together, and then we spent an hour afterwards talking about our journeys as to where we are and how we came to basically the same conclusion that it's all about power, man. It's all about, you know, it's all about setting us against each other. And I go back to something my first college roommate said to me, who was politically active then, but it was, you know, this is kind of a normie con back then, but, and I wasn't in any of those things. He said, look, you know, I remember him saying libertarians are proof positive that the political spectrum isn't a line, but a circle. Well, same thing with Marxists.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because in extreme Marxism, you get extreme individualism, you get extreme identitarian politics. On the extreme libertarian individualist left, you get a whole bunch of revolutionary, exclusionary, you're not good enough purity spiral. Both sides purity spiral into hating the other side to the point of exclusion of everybody else. And everybody else in the middle isn't good enough, carrying water for the bad guys. And I'm as guilty of this at times as anybody. Don't get me wrong. I will cop to this tendency, right? And so everybody has to constantly check their premises, error check themselves, and all the rest of it. So in that context, and as I get older and the more I do this, the more I realize that that is the case, and that we have to remind ourselves constantly of who are we being gaslit by and why at this moment in time. And, you know, ever increasingly and ever, even if it puts you in a position to take slings and arrows and opprobrium from one of the radical groups who may or may not have been at times in the past, one of your fellow travelers, right? I'm getting a whole lot of pushback from the old hard libertarian right, because I'm moving away from that political philosophy as applied to the moment of time that we're in. Mm-hmm. Remember, as you said, as you opened at the beginning about my willingness to gamify and strategize through all this, that as I went through this, I'm like, no, we have to have an order of operations. This is my arguments with the Federal Reserve, for example. I've always said that, yeah, we want to get rid of the Fed because the central banking is a bad idea, but do we want to get rid of the central bank in the United States at a time when all the other countries aren't getting rid of their central banks? So it's like saying to yourself, I want to fight a war by taking your army and disbanding. Makes no sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you analyze the world from that perspective, and when you start to integrate that wholly into your analytic framework, and you say to yourself, okay, I have a goal in mind. I know what I'd like to see, but I don't know what the outcome is going to be. So all I can do is step by step move towards a conclusion that I would like to see us go, and I'll advocate for that while trying to do my best to explain where we are at any moment. Excuse me, any particular moment in time.
By the way, you do or have done with me at least, and all my viewers, a great job of that. Mm. And I'm not saying that to stroke your ego or anything like that, but But I am saying it to affirm you, and that's why I love having you on.
Right.
You do a great job of that. So go ahead.
Well, yeah, you know, and thank you for covering the fact that I somehow, like, I felt like I swallowed a bug. Which I'm like, and I'm looking at
it's
love bug season here in North Florida. So I'm watching them every once in a while, like make it into the bedroom through the air conditioner. And it's just really annoying. I'm like, no, I hope I didn't swallow a love bug. Those things are nasty. That being said, okay. So we may need to cut this out or not. Leave it
no,
there.
No, we're really letting it roll.
Doesn't matter, whatever. Do the raw thing. I don't give a shit. So, but what I'm getting at here is, I guess where I'm going with this is we now stand at a very interesting moment in time where there is the first time in a long time that we have the opportunity to seize on the opportunity for the center to put up boundaries and say, that's enough. This is as far as we're going to go. This level of political violence is not acceptable. We went through it in the 60s with Martin Luther King and, you know, Robert F. Kennedy. And, you know, it culminates in Kent State, which eventually culminates in Nixon winning 49 states since 1972. And then soon after that, ending the Vietnam War, which for his reward for that was Watergate and being, you know, thrown out of office. We all know the story.
Right.
Okay. Well, you know, where are we here with Trump? Now, 1968 to 1972 is not an analog. It's not a prologue to 2025 through 2028. Hate to break it to everybody, but that's not the way history works. It rhymes a little bit, but it doesn't actually, you know, it doesn't repeat. Circumstances are fundamentally different today than they were 50 years ago. And so, you know, we're different people, with different people in charge, with different, you know, generational cohorts working against the other, different levels of technology and everything else, all of that. So what we need to do now is really reflect on what conditions were created in order to bring about the murder of Charlie Kirk. Again, does not matter whether it was done by, you know, by state actor, by proxy, or this kid on his own, the lone gunman, or whatever. It doesn't matter. It does not matter. And please don't waste any amount of your time worrying about any of that. Eventually, some version of the story that's closer to the truth will come out, or it won't. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is realize that the conditions were set to generate all of these responses in both you and everyone around you, and then ask yourself, how are you being played? How are you being, you know, the truth is not going to set you free here. The truth is only going to make things worse if you seek it in this particular context. And I know that really bothers a lot of people to say something like that, but that's exactly what they would like you to do. If there is an agenda here, it is to muddy the information space, keep you gaslit, keep you tilting at windmills and peering around corners into shadows and everything else. It's like, to say some people yesterday, I looked up right before I was doing my market report on Sunday morning. I looked over my Slack server and somebody had posted up some video from, you know, a couple of people who were now theorizing that it wasn't a 30-06 rifle from 200 yards away, that it was the guy standing off to the right of the stage with a pistol. And I'm like, yeah, sorry, don't buy it. Pistols don't sound like that. Mm-hmm. Know full well that was the sound of the 30-06, because I've heard a lot of 30-06 go down range.
Yeah.
That's not a gun. That's not a pistol shot. That was a rifle crack. And so done. Does not matter. Everything else you think you want to know. And I'm like, stop engagement farming, because now all of your conspiracy minded audience clickbaiting bullshit, your fucking business model has been destroyed by an act of clarity.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. It doesn't work like that anymore. You don't get to be in that. You're going to lose that source of revenue. Go out and get a real job. Leave it to the professionals. Okay. And I'm not even saying I'm one of the professionals. Mm-hmm. Seriously, at a certain level, you just have to like stop it, because that level of analysis, that type of analysis is designed to rob everybody of the energy necessary to do what needs to be done, which is to come together and declare boundaries and to have the conversations in their homes with their children who are feel disaffected and everything. We have a moment here where parents and children have to begin reconnecting and figure out, what are we going to do to get out of this? And Scott Bessent let us know what the answer was the other day. And so did Trump. We have to succeed our way out of this. We have to give people the ability to feel like they have agency and a way to get out of their disenfranchisement. Okay? Both on the left and the right, both on the griper right and the friggin' Trantifa left. That's the dyad you want to view this through. You can view it through any number of different, you know. And all of these things, all of these dyads are all being accelerated all at once. You know, violence against, Muslims in England, in Ireland, everywhere. And not even saying at a certain level that I don't even disagree with any of these reactions. My opinion on this is irrelevant. Okay. My personal opinion on a lot of this stuff is irrelevant. What matters is that there's clearly an objective now to accelerate X. And accelerate all of these things towards a particular conclusion. And what's that conclusion? We need to start World War III in Europe. We need to repudiate and destroy Trump. We need to destroy the United States because Europe and the old colonial powers of Europe cannot live with a functioning United States that comes together, period. We have to keep the quote unquote center right and center left from ever growing a freaking brain and saying, nope, that's it. We're done. We're re-establishing the Republic. We're going to rebuild trust in the institutions because the institutions have to have some form of trust rebuilt in them. But in order to do that, we first have to tear down the rotten institutions while at the same time reminding everybody that we still have the agency and the capability and the capital to build new institutions that are better.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly what 2025 has been calendar date has been a repudiation, has been an attempt to accelerate all institutional, any vestige of institutional respect.
Yeah.
Right? So, right. That means go after each of the cabinet members in turn. It means scream that there hasn't been one goddamned arrest. I think these are people who are friends of mine who don't see the problem. I did 2 hours on Mike Ferris' show the other day with my friend, Lieutenant Colonel Steve Murray. And we were went off screaming, just arrest somebody, just goddamn arrest one person. Like, well, maybe you can't. Who do you want arrested? You arrest some low-level functionary, you don't care. You want Hillary Clinton, you want Barack Obama, you want John Brennan. You're not going to get them under the right, until you get to the right set of circumstances, until you set the game board in such a way that you go, yep, now we're taking that rook off the board. You're still moving pawns around the board. Why? Because that's how badly we were being outplayed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so and anybody listening to my voice, and I'm telling you, I'm getting a lot of pushback on this. And I know where it's coming from. And I'm like, I see you folks. I know who you are. I know who you work for. Everybody telling you that's not good enough is carrying water.
Mm-hmm.
Or they are they just don't care. They just want to win. I get it. I want wins, but the wins have to happen at a particular moment in time. The wins have to happen after certain things are set in motion, because it's not us out on the fringe of the political spectrum, of the political commentary at, who can see the future.
Mm-hmm.
We don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
If I mattered that much, I wouldn't have 63,000 people following me on Twitter. I'd have 640,000 people following me on Twitter, or 6 million, but I don't, like Charlie Kirk, but I don't. You know why? Because what I'm talking about, only a certain group of people can really, truly understand. But that's where the new ideas percolate towards the center. The center has to be brought up to speed, the fact that the Federal Reserve, one, exists. Two is corrupt. Three is what it actually does. Like, we have to start the process there. We gotta remind everybody. Most people don't know that Trump has been completely and utterly in the right, vis-a-vis his Article II powers. He can do everything that he's tried to do this year. Mm-hmm. But the judiciary has blocked him at every turn. So what do you do? Well, if you're Trump and you have an ignorant electorate, and I didn't say stupid, I said ignorant or uneducated electorate.
Mm-hmm.
What do? You educate them.
Mm-hmm.
You have to educate them. How do you educate them? You say, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, which is completely legal. And then some judge steps in and says, no. And then the Democrats scream, he's a king and he's a dictator and he's a this and he's a that. And then the Supreme Court goes, oh, by the way, nope, sorry, Trump was right all along.
Right.
another 50,000 people fall out of the, fall out of the spell of, Trump is Hitler.
Yeah.
Each time something like that happened, another 50, 100,000 people, every time Charlie Kirk would go on a college campus and speak to a bunch of people, another 50 or 100 or 200 people would fall out. And this is how you deprogram.
Yeah.
And how you educate so that you then have the political power to override a treasonous Congress that would impeach and arrest Trump tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
If they had just one justifiable offense that they could get 60% of the vote on in the House and the Senate.
Right.
And that ain't that hard, folks, since, they're already working at like 53 in the Senate who hate him, if not 55.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We only need five people there. So all you got to do is move, however many House votes it is, 20, 30 House votes, right? So, 40 House votes, right? You go from, not even 20, right? And mm-hmm. So that's not a lot.
Yeah.
That's the Republic hanging by a fucking thread. And you're sitting there screaming that Kosh Patel is a freaking traitor. Like, really?
Well, on that, and this is my own personal journey, and it's relevant to the conversation, but this is not just to blindly support exactly what you're saying. But I was thinking of like the Epstein files. I've gotten to the point, I don't really need to know. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason, there's just reasons I don't need to know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
And that makes absolute sense.
It doesn't mean I don't have empathy for the victims. It doesn't mean that I don't want justice. I want all of that. But there's certain things we culturally or as people just shouldn't know.
Well, and remember, there's a lot of things about the Epstein files.
Right.
There's a lot there. And I'm not saying, this is just Donald Trump's a pedophile. No. Clearly, we already had the Speaker of the friggin' House come out and say that Donald Trump worked with the FBI in order to catch Jeffrey Epstein the first friggin' time. So, oops, that story doesn't hold friggin' water. No. Clearly, Trump is holding back the Epstein files as leverage.
Yeah. You mentioned that when one of our first talks, and it's about leverage politics. And I never forgot that. But so I've come to that conclusion. And the other thing is, and you mentioned something about 10 minutes ago that I think we need to reflect back on and go to. We got to grow our way out of this and we got to succeed. And we got to win. That's how you win the game, right?
Right. Is you win the game, so how do you roll your way out of it? You get rid of the ridiculous regulations. You cut the size and scope of government. But if you got a Congress that won't let you cut anything because you can't get any of your people appointed to go into the agencies to actually start gutting the departments and doing their jobs, which is the truth, by the way. Mm-hmm. Okay. Like, this is real. And every day that someone's out there going, day 162, that there's been no damn arrest. I'm like, okay. Have you looked at the list of people that, haven't been approved yet? Like, at some point, the Senate finally had to go to the level of saying, okay, that's it. We're done with the filibuster for now. We're done with this. We're 51 votes and we're passing shit and we're pushing all these people through. Like, that's it. We're done. And, the way I would do this is, again, I really like Stephen Miller. I think he's hilarious. If I were Stephen Miller, I'd be like, yeah, we're going to get rid of the filibuster. We're going to put everything through we want. And then right before the term is over, we're going to put the filibuster back in place. That's what I would do. I'm like, look, if you're going to act like this, if you're going to act like children, because we know you aren't actually acting in the best interest of the country in any way, you're not acting in good faith by saying this is a legitimate president who has a legitimate right to run the government. If you're acting in that way, then legitimately you don't get a vote either.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get a voice, and we're going to do that. And oh, by the way, we're going to be so successful at that that we're going to win the midterms anyway. And then you're not going to have to, and then we're never going to have to listen to you people ever again. Because as you sit down, because it's clear what they're going to do now, they're going to double down on the idea that Charlie Kirk deserved to die.
Mm-hmm.
because they don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
And the note this morning that Kathy Hochul and the governor of New York is endorsing Mamdani for mayor is a classic example. This is what they're doing. They're mm-hmm. going to go to the map with probably in the hope that some idiot will shoot Mamdani, and then they'll use that as a means by which to balance the scales for Charlie Kirk. So, false flag coming in 3-2-1, right? Like,
right.
This is the game. You have to start thinking like these people. I was having that conversation with my daughter last night, and I'm like, you have to realize, hon, that, you know, sometimes I sound like an absolute lunatic in the house while I'm working shit out, because I'm literally spending my day every day in the minds of multiple Emperor Palpatines.
Yeah, right.
And I'm like, I know that, and just never forget. And then every once in a while, I have to like sit her down and go, oh, by the way, this is who I actually am. And, you know, but she doesn't get to see that on a regular basis. She doesn't always get to see that. Sometimes she walks through, she's on her way home from where she comes in, and she's walking, you know, coming in from work, and we're on the back porch. I'm smoking a cigar, chatting with the wife, and you know, and all this crap is coming out of my mouth. And she's like, and rightfully so, right? But she's coming into the middle of the conversation and not the end of the conversation, you know, and not the beginning of it, right? And that's itself a metaphor for what we do on social media every day.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's a crazy world. Domestic politics are a mess. And until this Congress is gone,
mm-hmm.
we're not going to be happy with the outcome of, we're not going to be happy with the outcomes because we want things to go faster and we think we're in charge, but we're not in charge.
Mm-hmm.
At all. And if the last 9 months have not proven to you that the decent people are really in charge of all of the systems, then you don't understand the situation. And then mm-hmm. to turn around and indulge the accelerationists of the Nick Fuentes variety, and I'm calling that fucking rat fuck out, then if you embrace that, well, then you're part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you're just cherry picking that which you want. That you're just cherry picking and using that as a means by which to justify your own impotence as a human for having let these things get to this point. When what you really should be doing is putting down the friggin' phone, logging off a goddamn Twitter, and go and fix a problem in your hometown.
Yeah. Or in your family, engage with your kids or your wife or
anything.
Whatever.
Go coach a little league team. Go fix a pothole. Go do some fucking thing. Like, seriously. It's like that line from Midnight Run. Sydney, sit down and eat, have a cream soda, eat a sandwich, do some fucking thing. Like, you know, something, anything. Go do something purposeful that fixes somebody's problem in your community and gives them back 30 seconds to a minute of their time every day. Watch that mm-hmm. propagate itself. If everybody did that once a week, a lot of our towns would fix themselves really quickly.
Right.
All of a sudden, everybody would have an extra half an hour in their day, and they'd be like, now what? And we have people in charge up on Capitol Hill that are literally trying not to steal those 30 minutes back from us. When Obama was in charge, when the Biden junta was in charge, every time we tried to create some level of comfort and semblance of safety, they would target that and destroy it and take mm-hmm. even more of your life away from you. So we have to, bit by bit, minute by minute, block by block, action by action, take our communities back. And how are you going to do that? The big stuff is going to be handled on Capitol Hill,
mm-hmm.
right? The Fannie and Freddie, probably. I mean, I take Bessent at his word. He's going to declare an emergency in housing. And I bet you it's going to be timed with the Fannie and Freddie IPO, because he has to unlock the mortgage market. They've got to get consumer credit flowing to the small and medium business owners, in the middle class and in the upper lower classes, who can't get access to consumer credit because of unbelievably ridiculous and onerous underwriting rules that were put in place after 2008. Like this is my new jam, man. Like, this is it. This is the mm-hmm. big thing. You want to fix the country? It's got to start there. And Charlie Kirk, God bless his soul, began to understand that. So, but he went and talked to leftists who were like these purple hairs on campus, and they were all like screaming about, you know, BlackRock and, you know, private equity taking people out of their homes. And then Charlie was like, yeah, I think we should just pass a law. You had assets under management over, you know, $500 billion. And by the time he was done with the clip, he was down to $100 billion. He's like, you don't get to buy single family homes in America. You're barred from doing so. Is that draconian? Yeah. Is it unlibertarian? Yeah. Who gives a fuck? It's also right. Because BlackRock can't be going in there and buying those houses. And then Blackstone, BlackRock, and all the rest of those private equity motherfuckers are going in there, right? They're buying up burb claves for $300,000 a house, right? And then they turn around, they buy them all up, and then they sell one to the other one for $700,000, set the comps and move the freaking prices up to $700,000, and then turn to the banks and go lend at 6%. And they're making money on it. They're making money going blind. Like, it's bullshit. It's got to end. I don't give a shit. I don't care what that sounds like anymore. I don't care. We have to get people back into homes. We have to give people the ability to believe that they have a future, that they can raise a family, that they can begin to rebuild generational wealth. And the path to that is the fixed rate 30-year mortgage guaranteed with a government-guaranteed government backstop that pays better than treasury bills. It's not a friggin' hard system. We ran it for an awfully long fucking time until the Eurodollar system in the end of and the imposition of LIBOR and the Plaza Accord and all that. The more I think about this, the more I'm like, I can see it all now of how they betrayed the entirety of the mortgage market in the United States. And they destroyed it on purpose to destroy the wealth generating ability of the middle class. And then they gave us Obamacare to suck away the rest of our money. And then they did this and they did that. And there's no money left. You're 25 years old. You're graduating college. You're 22, 23 years old. You're supposed to be able to get a job that's enough, that's making enough money to be able to go out and buy a starter home and start a family. Yeah, you need 20% down. You got no equity, right? You need 20% down. And the average starter home is $275,000.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So now you need $56,000, $55,000 in the bank.
To buy a home.
Who's got that? Who comes out of college with $55,000 in capital? Okay, you get an FHA loan. Sure. And then you need 3.5%. Then you got to go to your parents for that. Your boomer parents are like, they're the ones who made out like a fucking bandit, you know, selling their house they bought in 1968 for a postage stamp and a rolled up newspaper. And then they sold it for $750,000 and they're living on fixed income down in Florida, and their profits down in Florida would on a place that they paid $200,000 for. $300,000 for, and now they're sitting on like, fuck it. They don't even want it. And they're like, tell their kids, why did it? Why can't you? I go, this is the reason, dad. Like, you can't go to the bank, dad, because the boomers had $48,000, all of them. You know, and the average boomer had, you know, retired with $48,000 in his 401k.
Right.
And he didn't have anything because he didn't save. Maybe he couldn't save. Why? Yeah. Because of inflation, because of this, because of that, all of that stuff. So that's got that process. Got to end. We have to short circuit that as quickly as possible.
Is that
in
coming?
In order to stop the further radicalization and marginalization of the Trantifa left and the Graper right. Because they're both screaming about the same goddamn thing.
Is that coming?
That's why they're getting violent.
You think that's coming? That fix is coming?
I think that fix wants to come. I think that's what the Trump administration understands. And I think everybody on Capitol Hill who hates Trump is trying to stop it from happening. Why? Because these people are fucking communists. It's not that damn hard.
It's about power, as you said.
You have the true believers in communism, and they're the lieutenants stabbed in all these departments and all these HR departments and all these underwriting. No idea what I've been going through trying to get a simple cash out remortgage on my house in Florida and help, like, you know, to consolidate some debts and do some work, right? Nothing crazy. You know, you can look up on Craftreon how much, you know, Gold Dust and Guns makes. I don't, you know, my life is an open fucking book. And you're like, you should have no problem getting that mortgage. I'm like, yeah, I should. I've been fighting with the fucking underwriter for 2 months. I finally just said the other day, no. Fuck you. I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
I don't need your freaking business this bad. But that story? Not on me. I've been, I, you know, this has been going on for 3 months, like behind the scenes in my house. I'm like, And it's wrong. And I know that me telling that story, I can tell you there's probably 100 people who are, when they watch this, are going to be typing in furiously in the comments that they ran into the same damn thing. Because they're not on the W-2, because they're self-employed, the underwriters are up their ass all the way back to the time that they were like 4 years old.
Yeah.
Give them a loan. Why? Because Elizabeth Warren told them that's what they had to do.
Yeah.
That system needs to die. It needs to die in a fire. It needs to die in a fiery blaze of inhuman death. Like, it's got to go. If you want to save this country, it's got to start there. People have to believe that they have the right to property.
Yeah. You know, it works really well with what we saw, the trend that we saw of just even bank consolidation, where it's all these community banks either going tits up or getting bought out, and having just a handful of regional banks, if you would, that will judge you getting a loan by an algorithm. It's no longer.
Yeah, no, it's an algorithm. It's everything is, it's that, and it's a bunch of purple hairs.
Mm-hmm.
And angry black women having been pushed into these things, women who don't even know what a spreadsheet is. Like, I'm sorry. This is where I am on this. Yeah. And that might sound terrible or horrible, whatever. I don't give a shit. Like, at this point, I don't care. Because I know full well that this has been going on for 15 years or 17 years since Dodd-Frank and everything else.
Yeah.
Starbucks and Dodd-Frank and all the other stuff. There's probably a bunch of other stuff that I've missed, but just that I know of, you know, you start talking about that. You start talking about underwriting, forget it. You don't have 2 years of current taxes that are stable minimum. And all the rules are designed that if you like, I'm going to make it really simple for you. What small business owner do you know that files their taxes and pays them on April 15th?
None.
Right. Why? Because they
file an extension. Yeah.
They ought to file an extension because they've got too much on their plate. They've got too many freaking papers to get together. Probably by April 15th, they don't even have half the documents that they need. So they file an extension for September. You know what that means? That means that on April 16th, your current taxes that the underwriting rules require, you're now a year out of date. Because, for example, this year you need your 2024 taxes put into effect, right? You have to have them done. Otherwise, you're going off of 2022 and 2023. Then they start going, well, are you going to make the same amount of money in 2024? You haven't filed your taxes yet. We don't know. Mm-hmm. So I need a P&L for 2024. I need a P&L for 2025. I need this certified letter. And blah, 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 blah. I can go on and on and on and on and on. God forbid you actually have, you know, a properly designed LLC structure to both protect yourself legally from certain things and, you know, do a simple tax minimization strategy, and forget that you're now a money launderer.
Right.
This is standard shit that everybody does because we can't bring our books in and say, here are our books. Here's our cash flow. This is what we make. This is how much. Here's our, do the math. They're not allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So between September, April 15th and September 15th of every year, or October 15th of every year, if you have a small business, don't apply for a mortgage.
Yeah.
Just don't. Mm-hmm. Wait until you've got your current year taxes and only apply for a mortgage between October 15th and April 15th.
Yeah.
Because I literally ran into this earlier in the year. I'm like, I was trying to get a construction loan. Built the property and I've got up in Tennessee for a second home. Had no problem in the middle of March because my 2023 taxes were current.
Right.
In July, they're not current anymore.
Yeah. I have the same problem, just to be candid. I have a small business. My wife has a small business. We have filed an extension because of cash flow and also just being overwhelmed.
I mean, yeah. Andy, like, I overpaid an estimated taxes on April 15th. Like, I paid my taxes up front.
Right.
And I, you know, if you think I only make this amount of money, why did I pay half of that in taxes?
Right.
Last I checked, someone in my tax bracket, you know, in my income bracket doesn't pay 50% in income taxes. Sorry. Yeah. Not even with self-employment taxes, it looked like that. Like, your math is off. And you know what? Sorry, but your math is off because you're an asshole. And you're trying to deny me the loan because you don't want to give me the loan because you're an asshole. Why? Because you're a fucking communist.
Yeah.
That's why. Fuck you. You're a communist. I'm calling you that now because you're a communist. How's that? And I'm going to be reductionist about this because there really is only one thing to deal with now is the unquenchable envy and nihilism of a communism. Marxism at its core is a nihilistic view of the universe. Period. I don't have to be a capitalist to say that either, by the way. Like, this is where, this is the thing. And we have to, this is the line we have to draw. We're decent people. We're trying to get through our day. We're trying to, you know, live and build wealth. No, you're not allowed to build wealth. Why? Because some fucking inbred asshole at the top of the freaking power structure over in freaking Europe or wherever doesn't want you to build wealth. He wants you to be a tax consumer. He wants you to be a feudal slave. That's why Ron DeSantis is the best governor of America. And I'll put that up against anybody, and I'll open up the WFC page to do it. Because the guy's talking about getting rid of property taxes for primary residences in Florida. She said it doesn't even bring in all that much money in the first place.
Yeah.
It's budget dust in a state like Florida. And they're like, you're just Florida because you're rich. I'm like, yeah, we're well run.
Yeah.
So we should be punished? Like, how about if all the other states get their shit together? But if Florida passes that in 2026, that spreads like wildfire.
I hope so. I hope so. So,
and the feudalism, dude, it's like, we you have to realize this is feudalism.
Yeah.
We are tenants and sharecroppers on our own fucking land.
Yeah. That brings up a great point. And I see it, and it's happening now. I want your opinion on that. And then I'd like to get to Europe. I'm just taking my time here.
I know. I'm also taking up all the time.
No, well, I have another interview at the bottom of the hour, but I'll text him online when I'm with you to delay it. Because this is gold.
I think we can wrap up in the last 30 minutes.
Okay. But what do you see the US becoming a lot more regional, for example?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Talk to me about that.
No, I mean, we're
just already there.
I mean, look, the winds are piling up in every corner. This is why I get really angry with the accelerationists, because there's a moon going fast enough. I'm like, dude, the Department of War now just announced that they're not going to follow the 2018/re-upped 2022 National Defense Authorization Act, which says that we have to, the Department of Defense, now the Department of War, has to, you know, prepare for a two-front war against China and Russia. Do you know why? It's like they're playing word games. Commies play word games, so we're playing word games. The reason why Trump said Gulf of America was so that all the contracts that are written against the Gulf of Mexico don't matter anymore. Like, we just changed the friggin' you changed the definition. Oh, look, that treaty doesn't matter anymore. It's the Gulf. You're referencing a body of water that doesn't exist. We do not recognize the Gulf of Mexico as a thing. Therefore, well, it's the same kind of. I think it's the same kind of thing. I preface these comments. I've said this in a couple of different forums, and I'm like, if that's what they did here by redefining the Department of Defense, Department of War, in order to ignore the NDAA so that they can change U.S. foreign, they can change the direction and the preparation stance of the Department of Defense.
Genius.
Genius. Simple. Hey, we'll just change the name.
I haven't thought of that. Genius.
And then
right?
they turn around and say, yeah, we're going to reorient against, you know, we're going to reorient to, you know, create Fortress America, which is the clearest signal to the Russians and the Chinese that the age of U.S. global hegemony on behalf of our, you know, British forebears is over.
Yeah.
And then this morning, if you want more receipts on that, how about this morning?
Okay, this is it right here. This is why we're talking right here. Go ahead.
You want another receipt? I got one for you.
Yeah, tell me.
Best news of the day. American advisors are in Belarus talking about, you know, coordinating, military, you know, exercises. While the Germans and the French are moving tanks into Poland.
Right.
Right? Like, here, let me get the actual thing so that we're not weird, okay? Let's get the actual thing. U.S. military officers attend Russia-Belarus war games. Okay? How? This has not happened since the beginning of the Cold War. Okay?
Right?
This is a major, major thing. And then here's your next...
Tom, this is amazing.
Then your next receipt. Ready? Yeah. And everybody's getting it wrong because everybody wants to hate the United States because everybody in the commentariat, well, has shown us who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Trump comes out and he says, I will put sanctions on Russia if the Europeans, you know, let's put 100% sanctions on the Russians if the Europeans will agree to not buy any more Russian oil by proxy from India or China. Blah, 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 blah. I'll match it.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing full fucking well that they're not going to. This is his way of saying, hey, why don't you do this thing that will destroy your economy?
Yeah.
And if you do that, I'll follow you to war in Russia.
What?
Meaning, Trump doesn't want to go to war
right.
in Russia because against the Russians because, goddamn it, he knows the Europeans are never going to agree to that. And then guess what? 6 hours later, the Europeans come out and say, no, we're not. We don't accept President Trump's offer because that would be terrible for us. Like, no, really? You think? Okay, I'm sorry. Like, it's so very fucking obvious. They don't want to do this. And so Trump maneuvered them, just like he maneuvered them in Washington, D.C. Before they sat down to talk policy, he struggle sessioned them through all publicly having to declare they want peace while they machinate for war.
Right.
So it's like, this is the game that's being played. This is allowing Trump to turn around and say, this is their war. It's not my war.
Yeah.
I don't want to be involved in this. If they go to war, I can wash my hands of them completely. They're playing both sides. I'm not playing this game. I'm willing to stand up to Putin and do what needs to be done. Lindsey Graham and Blumenthal are out there trying to you know, push something through Congress to force his hand. I'm like, you pass a bill, Lindsey, you think you're going to get 60 votes on that? You think you're going to get enough or 66 votes to override a presidential veto because you think Trump is going to sign that?
Right, right.
No, of course he's not going to sign it.
Yeah.
Well, so let's play the game all you want, folks, but you're going to lose. It's like, I'm sorry, I'm a half a step ahead of you.
Yeah.
I'm going to get to the 3-wood spot before you do. And then I'm going to take the 2 reeds. And then I'm going to expand my farm. And then I'm going to score 15 fucking points.
Right.
Ooh, you're behind by a point. You needed to go there first. And you can't do it because if you do, then your game is like, it's over. Game is already over. It's just a matter of playing it out. I'm making, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, I'm making an Agricola reference. When I say I'm going to the 3-wood spot, then I'm going to take the reeds. And if you don't know what Agricola is, everybody should play Agricola at least once, even if you absolutely despise it, because it's one of the great worker placement games ever made. Even if I don't even like the game. But my point is that Agricola is all about timing. It's a very passive aggressive game. But modern geopolitics, as played by the British and played by the Europeans and everybody else, and when you get into the diplomatic space, it is a very passive aggressive thing where I'm going to make this move to block you before you do this. I mean, you can use chess, but it's better if you've got like 5 people at the table and Agricola plays 6. Like, you, I mean, not that I would ever play a 6 game, the Agricola player game of Agricola would take 12 hours to play, like the dumbest thing imaginable. It's 6 people, 3 is about all I can really stand, and then it's very dicey. I'm like, really? Can't we play like Caverna instead? It's a lot easier. But you know, I've got 13 other midweight Euros I'd rather play than worker placement Euros I'd rather play than Agricola. And I think most of my gaming crew would agree with me about that. But that being said, so shout out to those guys. But my point being is that this is the kind of analysis you have to engage in to understand that. I use the metaphor all the time of the Gantt chart, right? Of the Microsoft project file of, well, this task has to be completed on this date, and by then it'll be done, and this one's state dependent on that, and blah, blah, blah. And I've always said that Evil Corp Central, or Davos, or whatever you want to call them, have their Gantt chart. Well, under the Trump administration, they have a Gantt chart. It's very clear they have one, and it's being run by Stephen Miller. And I'll I'll bet anybody $1,000 that it's Stephen Miller running the Gantt chart. Okay.
Okay.
And my point being is that Miller knows what's on their Gantt chart, and he's half a move ahead of them at moving his agenda forward. And they're constantly having to augment he's got the operational tempo.
Yeah.
Right. So he's just executing, and now they're having to scramble behind the scenes. So they never thought that Trump and company would ever be this organized, but they are actually organized. So every lame attempt at trying to derail them, they're like, well, you know, if they do that, then we just do this. Mm-hmm. And we'll just execute on this part of the Gantt chart where we wait for this to happen. But we already knew they were going to do that. So we really didn't have the, you know, if we get that one, you know, in May, like this little bit of policy, if we're going to push that thing forward, to push the pawn forward on that, great. And if they obstruct us on it, well, we never expected it to get done until September anyway, because it'll take that much time to go through the course. But if we get it in May, great. We'll just keep, then it just means that we can move these other things up, and we can pull these things out, and then they're fucked. Like, this is the way they're playing the game. This is the way real politics is done. And it's a mix of that plus about a lot of people reacting in real time to exogenous events like Charlie Kirk getting killed.
Yeah.
Or some other event like that. And so I can believe, for example, that they had the Charlie Kirk assassination. And I use the word assassination explicitly on their Gantt chart. Right. But they didn't have Arina Peruzka and the video of her getting stabbed in the neck in a Charlotte train, finally breaking containment the day before, or 2 days, 3 days before, whatever it was, and getting to the point where that was now reaching a fever pitch. So at that point, the Charlie Kirk thing becomes not an incitement to, it doesn't have the same impact. If Arena's murder wasn't public and lighting through the public like wildfire, when Charlie gets shot, I don't think Charlie Kirk's death has as much impact.
Really?
I don't. I think on the one hand, this is something my wife said to me yesterday. She said, you know, on Tuesday, it was video of my daughter getting stabbed.
Right.
And on Wednesday, it was my husband getting shot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not in anywhere nearly.
No, I know what you're saying, though.
But the basic concept is still the same.
Same.
On any given day of the week, take any 5 minutes of this podcast, and I'm far more inflammatory than anything Charlie Kirk ever said in his entire fucking life.
Yeah.
Man. Imagine, you know, that. But because, you know, and maybe it's because I'm what I am, that I get to stay in this little corner of the universe, and I'm quite comfortable there. I don't do this for fame and fortune. I do this to make just enough money to continue doing it, basically, you know, and for the purposes of, like, to me, this is my mission, right? Charlie had his mission. I have mine. We all have ours. Mm-hmm. We all have one. And God's bless us that we do, for Christ's sake. We should have missions.
Yeah.
We should have purpose, right? Mm-hmm. We should do this for whatever reason, you know, whatever reason we do what we do, you know, hopefully for good and constructive reasons. Right. And then you let the chips fall where they may, and you either are good at it and people think it's valuable, or they don't. And then you find out that it's not good. And then you either evolve, iterate, or move on.
Right.
Well, I want to pull on this. I want to go there now because I think it's set up really well. Sure. France and Germany here.
Mm-hmm.
So right before all this happened, France government basically imploded.
Yep.
Germany, and I'll say it, I don't know if it was 7 or 8 political assassinations in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Weave that into this. And you've mentioned that Europe's fallen apart. You've mentioned that many times. Europe needs war. Weave all of that into this discussion right now, if you would.
Sure.
How does that fit in? And also the whole, I find it fascinating that we're in Belarus
playing war games with the Russians. Correct me.
Observing Russian Belarusian war games. Right. I mean, when you think about it from that perspective, it is quite amazing that the Russians would, you know, allow us to go send observers to what they're doing. Like, I think it's hilarious, right?
Well, okay. So you know me well enough that I'm not laughing at you. I'm just laughing.
No,
at
I know you're just laughing. Like it is kind of. It's the kind of laughter that it's a tension release laughter is what it is.
I fully
understand that.
I didn't realize that. And
yeah, no, it's all
it
good.
It's confusing too, because Russia just met, I mean, the whole Alaskan summit,
all of that.
And then, okay, we got Ukraine. Then it's talking tough to all this. And now we're, yeah. Okay. So just explain all this.
I mean, so France, and then get downgraded by Fitch or whatever on Friday last week. Right. Finally.
Right.
Like, oh my God, you only went down one rating? How about four? You know?
Right, right. But
what I would suggest everybody do is you think that the propaganda is hot and heavy surrounding Charlie Kirk. Well, the propaganda surrounding the US bond market is 10 times worse.
Tell me.
Dude, go look at the free yields.
Yeah. They're going down.
Yeah. Like all the long end of the curve is dropping. Moreover, the curve is flattening. Like the 7-10 spread, the 10-30 spread, the 5-7 spread, they're all rolling over. They're not blowing out. We're not getting a bear steepening trade. We're getting a bull flattening trade, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, in anticipation of the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates. And sure, I think Powell should cut by 50 and surprise the markets on Wednesday. I've been saying this for a while. I'm with Trump that, but for different reasons than Trump. I think Powell should cut by 50 just to shake everybody out of their complacency, but that would be me. I'm an asshole. I would go, you know what? I'm Jerome Powell. Everybody thinks that they know me because I'm so predictable. I know 50. What?
Right. What?
I mean, it'd be even better if he came out and said 75. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, okay. It's not like I'm not talking my book here that I wouldn't like to get a mortgage of 60 to 65 basis points lower than I was talking about 2 weeks ago, but yeah, no, never mind. I want that for everybody. I'm egalitarian when it comes to that. kidding. If I were Powell, I would do that. Not, you know, I would just front load the point that I'm gonna cut by this year anyway. Like you can, he's gonna go 50, 25, 25, or 25, 50, 25, or 25, 25, 50. He's gonna do something like that. Like
right.
As well just front load the damn thing and get stuff started, get the party started. And then let the inflationistas scream bloody murder, and they're going to be wrong, as always. But watching what's happening in the European bond markets versus the American bond markets, what you are seeing is a collapse of spreads. And that is a telltale sign that one government's institutional validity in the minds of bond traders is rising at the expense of another's. So in this scenario, what I've been doing for years is watching the US-German spread, either both the 2 and the 10, right? Because they're the benchmark rates. It's what everybody runs against. The 2-10 spread is what everybody runs against. So if you can watch the US-German 2-year spread and you watch the 10-year spread, you know, it's interesting. They should move in lockstep with one another if the Germans are taking their if there's, you know, the market believes that there's no difference in the long-term fortunes of the German versus the U.S. government governments and their fiscal positions. Point being is that why Germany? Well, Germany is the safe haven trade of Europe.
Right.
When European investors want to, pull out of risk, they want to go risk off and they want to stay in European assets, they move into the German Bund.
Right.
Historically speaking. But the interesting part about this is that I also track the Italian-German 10-year spread. That's been very interesting because over the last year, a little over a year since the Biden-Trump debate, which started the entire process, the spiraling towards endgame that we're seeing in Europe now, that spread has been collapsing. Italian debt used to trade at 160-plus basis points over German debt. Now it's 80.
What?
Now it's 80. Go look. I'll bring the numbers up right now. The German 10-year just closed at 271.
I'm checking it out.
Hold on.
Italy. Italy 10. And then the Italian 10-year closed at 35, 3.5. The German 10-year closed at 6.8. So 82 basis points.
So
now, I also noted, and I did this for my patrons, that every time that there was some kind of exogenous event to the markets, that the Italian spread would blow out versus the German spread. 5 to 10 basis points for a couple of days. There would be a blip, you know,
right,
spike, right? A little bit of signal in all the downsloping noise. Every one of those correlates to some major exogenous event in geopolitics or in the capital markets. And why is that? Well, we do know that Christine Lagarde has been running a massive yield curve control program called the Transmission Protection Instrument for 4 years now, 3 years now. So when there's a big move, generally speaking, everything moves in relation to the American market, right?
Right, right.
Generally speaking, if the American yields are dropping, everybody else's yields are dropping with it. If Powell's raising interest rates, everybody's raising interest rates.
Right,
but
right.
Note that Powell's held interest rates high all year long and everybody else has been cutting.
Right.
But the, for example, the UK 10-year is now trading at roughly 60 basis points above the American 10-year. It's a positive 60 spread. The last time it hit positive, it hit 60 basis points, Liz Truss lost her job. Now, with the Italian spread, what you know, what I was getting
so, at, this is fascinating. Go ahead, go ahead.
Oh, wait. So the Italian-German spread is really interesting because, well, of course, what happens is that when there's an exogenous event, Lagarde comes in and furiously buys German 10-years in order to suppress the yield, and the rest of the general market, European bond market, sells off, and she sits on the German, it caps the German yield so that there's a small sell-off in the Italian bond over the course of a couple of days because of liquidity problems. Lagarde sits on the German 10-year, the spread blows out, and then 2 days later, it goes back to baseline after the event is over. But they all correlate with these moments. Now, you can argue that there's maybe even more going on than that, and there probably is. I'm not that kind of forensic analysis. I don't need to do that. I just need to tell you that this is what's going on. But the trend is for Italy now to replace Germany as the safe haven trade in the minds of bond traders in Europe.
I would go in
that's
there.
What's going. That's what's happening.
Oh, think about that.
Why?
I want to know why.
Easy. Giorgia Meloni's in charge in Italy, and she's got the backing of Donald Trump, and there's 100 friggin' American military bases in Germany. I mean, in Italy. She's winning. The war and capital understands it. And they're moving there preferentially.
Wow.
Same thing with the French debts all getting crushed. The Germans are getting crushed. Everybody who wants to go to war
is getting crushed.
Are getting their bonds crushed. And the people who don't want to go to war are getting their bonds bid. The Americans and the Italians.
That's genius. Think about that.
To be honest with you, Andy, I've been living in this end of the world for so long, I consider this passé analysis.
No, I think it's genius.
I've been doing this for 3.5 years now, waiting for this moment. Lagarde defended 1.6. So German debt trades at a discount, at a discount to American debt above 160 basis points. It varies all over the place. But for the most part, the last 4 years that I've been tracking it, 3.5 years I've been tracking it, actually it's 4 years now because I started doing this in 2021 before Powell started cutting. Lagarde, every time the German US spread got down to 1.6, where American debt was had you know, this is the problem, right? The American debt sits here. UK is above us, France is, I think, above us now, and Germany's below us by a lot. And it bothers me to no end, by the way, that the German Bund trades at 135 basis points below the American Treasury of the same maturity. It's horseshit.
Right.
Sorry, yeah, it's complete horseshit.
Totally.
Created by, you know, thumb on the scale of justice and all of that shit, right?
Yeah.
So, but she defended two things for 4 years. And she's now having to defend just the cap versus the spread. She defended both the spread and the actual yield on the U.S. on the German 10-year for a long time, for the entirety of the Biden administration. She had help from Janet Yellen.
Okay.
Would sell tens and buy twos.
Right.
Or would issue twos in order to manipulate the supply of tens, like knowing full well that everybody needed tens for certain purposes. So she was issuing all that debt in twos, creating the inversion in our yield curve and keeping the supply of 10 years tight in order to help Lagarde manage the spread between German, between European debt and American debt. This was done on purpose. This is fucking clear as day if you followed it like I have every day for the last 4 years. Okay. Because it makes sense. And you watched Yellen at very specific times doing very specific things in order to save Lagarde's bacon when the spread started getting out of control. On top of that, Lagarde never for years, or for the first couple of years, didn't want the German 10-year closing on a monthly basis above 2.5%.
Okay.
Now she's had to back off to 2.7. In that time, it would, you know, it would blip up to 2.7, but then she'd smack it back down again, or up to 2.6 and smack it back down again. I mean, to the point where it could be trading at 2.65 all freaking week. And then in the last hour before the Friday close, she'd come in and bomb at 12 basis points. I'm not kidding.
Yeah. I've seen it.
To paint the tape on the close, to bang the close.
Yeah. I haven't seen this, but I've seen it.
Like, it was, and everybody's like focused on the gold market and the manipulation there and silver. Gold and silver aren't even being manipulated at this point. The manipulation is in the bond market and it's in the VIX.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then everything else is a derivative of the VIX on our equities and the bond markets in the United States and Europe. That's where they've been manipulating the markets, and gold and silver, you know, are drive-by shooting victims of that.
Yeah.
That process. And I'm sorry, that is just the truth, folks. And you need to get the shit out of your heads. There's too many gold grifters out there. There's too many silver grifters out there. Gold and silver are brilliant and I love them, but
no, I see what you're saying too.
As far as the real manipulation is concerned, it's about bond markets, not about gold and silver.
100%.
That story is so fucking 2004. It's not funny.
Well, and not to interrupt you, but I mean, I was in a hedge fund. This was years ago, and right. I deal with professional traders, and we all watch the bond market. That's the market we watch. That controls everything.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And so it's a sleight of hand to talk about gold directly that way. It really is about that. Now, I'm not saying that gold isn't manipulated at times, and they'll, you know, come in and, you know, over bomb a market in order to, like, you know, take you know, people out of their positions and whatnot, but it's nothing against, it's not the trend. The trends in gold and silver have nothing to do with that stuff. There is nefarious action in the gold and silver markets, don't get me wrong,
right?
But relative to the nefarious actions in the bond markets, those nefarious actions in the gold and silver markets can only exist if we have central banks rigging the bond market.
Yeah. Right?
Period. So this has been the big level up for me over the last 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand any of this shit when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Meaning when my beard actually had some black hair in, which is maybe 5 years ago. And you know, am I happy here watching gold trade above $3,700, silver above 43? Sure. I'm excited. Sure. What am I going to do? Complain? But I'm more interested in watching, you know, if you look at my watch list on investing.com, it's like the Japanese 10-year, the UK 10-year, the German 10-year, the US 10-year, the Euro, the Yuan, gold, silver, Bitcoin. Then we get into gold, you know, then we get into the safe haven assets, oil, the dollar index, the cash price of gold, the cash price of silver, right? And then I got into the ruble, the pound, the euro pound cross, the euro yen cross, you know, and then some other stuff. That's the stuff I look at on a regular basis. And then I chart, because that's giving a snapshot of the real game, right? And there's other things I could be looking at on a regular basis that, you know, and I'm sure I'm missing this stuff. And every once in a while, I'll dip in to see what's going on in the Hong Kong dollar market or something along those lines. But what we have a shift happening inside the European bond markets. We have the spreads collapsing. So meaning global bond traders are buying U.S. debt far faster and in far greater quantities. And remember, the U.S. bond markets are an order of magnitude bigger than the German bond markets. Let's not even kid ourselves. So it takes a lot of money to move the U.S. markets, and then very little money to move the German bond market, especially
relatively speaking, especially
during off hours. Like, it's not even hard, or during thin trade, during non-New York trading hours or non-European trading hours. not hard to move at all. So Lagarde's job here is pretty straightforward, and she's done it. But she's losing control of that as well, because it's, and this is the thing. And when I look at the way the German bond market has been trading, and I also note that for a long time, the 2 and the 10 were moving mostly in lockstep with one another. Every once in a while, they get a couple of basis points away from each other. But for the most part, you know, it was, if one was trading at 1.8, the other one was trading at 1.75 or 1.72 or, you know, 1.81 or whatever. It wasn't, they were trading in lockstep with one another. Only during two periods in the last 4 years has that been, was, did they get out of whack? And one was the late 2023, when we started getting, when the euro hit $1.02, and hit $1.03 and hit that, and then we had that big washout in the euro, and then the two plummeted versus the 10. But that was quickly corrected over the course of about 3 weeks. And then the whole thing shot up to 2.2%. Where German debt was literally trading at a 2.2% premium to American debt. It was insane.
That's insane.
Yeah. Coming into Trump's tariffs, and this is the interesting part, we started to get a split. And there's now the markets are betting that the Germans are going to go into recession much, much faster than they think than previously. Because if the 2 and the 10 are trading at, you know, the German, what it's implying is the German yield curve is out of whack.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
So the two is trading at a much lower, basically a 20 point inversion to the 10, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a split. When you think about all this, you have to like invert and play the game and everything else. So just let's put it that way. The same yield curve inversion that we're dealing with in the United States, they're dealing with in Germany.
Yeah, right now,
for those of you who understand this kind of geek speak. Now, here's the fun part. We started the year off, and Lagarde had moved the spreads way on all of this. Oh my God, Trump is going to destroy the world with his tariffs and this and that and everything. Well, we don't know, and everybody ran out of the U.S. dollar assets. Sorry, whatever. Thank you, Mark Carney, and all the rest of it. Then there was the tariff tantrum, and that was when we were trading at about 2% premium. Mm-hmm. We're now 1.35.
Yeah.
The acceleration down has been biblical since Trump negotiated the trade deal. Hold on for a second. Let me pull the chart. Let me pull my spreadsheet up to pull the chart real
quick. Yeah.
It won't take me more than a second.
No, go there. And I have a question about
just to make
that.
Sure that I get I'm getting the dates right here, because you can look all this stuff up. Oh no, sorry. Sorry, it was 2% on July 28th when the trade deal was announced. It's the 2 was at 2%, the 10 was at 1.75, and they've both fallen 40 basis points in a month and a half.
Okay. This goes
and,
to another.
And no end in sight. They're right. Going to continue tightening, meaning that what that means is the German debt is either being bought slower or sold faster than the American debt. American debt is falling in the yield. Right? It was like this. What's happening is that the German debt's not moving and the American yields are coming down, and no one's buying German debt with it commensurately. They're not maintaining. And why is this important? It's important because everybody sets all of their currency risk, their currency swaps on US versus, you know, US dollar versus euro. Dollar swap, you know, their currency swaps and their interest rates derivatives against that spread. If that spread gets outside of the fucking band of those contracts,
blows up.
The German banks blow up.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. That
That's
was going to be my question.
Watch this stuff.
Yeah.
Waiting for that detonation to occur. And I show this chart to my patrons all the time. Every once in a while, I throw it up on Twitter. I haven't thrown it up on Twitter in quite a long time. But if I were to show you the chart with all of the like annotations, on this day, the Bank of Japan defended the yen. And on this day, Lagarde panicked. And on this day, Trump won the election. And that's when USAID was shut. And that's when the tariffs went into effect. And this is the day they said we need war. I do this all the time, because after a while, I'm like, I just like look at bond spreads and then go back through the headlines. And go, oh, yeah, on that date, this happened. And on this day, this happened. and correlate so many things in the financial markets to the headlines. You can do this with the gold and silver ratio, by the way. The major peaks and troughs in the gold and silver ratio, regardless of the best of the trend line of the gold to silver ratio, but the major peaks and troughs in the gold to silver ratio correspond to major changes in global monetary policy.
Wow.
Period. Either peak or trough. They're not, you don't know what's going to happen is a major change is going, and it makes sense. A major change is going to happen in monetary policy. And therefore, at some point, someone's going to realize silver's cheap or gold is cheap relative to the other one. And then they're going to flip the trade and then they're going to let it ride.
Yep. Okay. So.
And for those in the audience who are wondering with bated breath, there's nothing interesting happening in the gold to silver ratio right now. Historically, the trend line is it should be trading at about 85 to 88 because it's been trending higher over the last 25 years. And the best fit line, a linear least squares regression of the gold of the monthly close of the gold to silver ratio over the last 25 years implies right around 85 to 88 should be where the ratio is headed.
It's doing what it should
do. When it's way above that, buy a lot of silver and don't buy very much gold. When it's below it, buy a lot of gold, not a lot of silver. When it's near the line, buy 50-50. Doesn't really for him. You're going to make money either way. But if you want to like fine tune the trade. But anybody selling you that we're going back to 13 on the gold to silver ratio, please unfollow them immediately because it is, we haven't traded a 13-to-1 ratio forever and a day. And there is no, and I mean zero good argument as to why that should be. Unless and until we get to the point where central banks around the world are putting silver into their reserves,
right,
to back their currencies, silver is an industrial metal and trades as such. You're better served actually if you want to know where silver is actually going. You're better served looking at silver versus copper,
right.
Which is a study I have not done yet, but it's probably one I'm going to start doing.
Well, I'd love to read that study. Listen, I'm having Martin Armstrong on Wednesday, and I'll send you the interview, but you did this. I'll give you all the credit. So I don't know how long we've been talking. I don't know, year and a few months or whatever.
Sure.
But what I mean by that is when we started talking, this was after the election, and this goes with the bond market, with what you just said. It's about money flow, Andy. That's Martin Armstrong. Correct me if I'm wrong.
It is. I learned it from Marty.
Yeah.
I told Marty that I went out to dinner with Marty and a few friends last week. I was on a show with him on the afternoon. I'm like, I'll see you in Tampa in a couple of hours. I'll see you in St. Pete in a couple of hours. And we had a great time. We had a great talk. And yeah, it's like, I told him, like, flat out, I'm like, dude, I learned it all. Like,
well,
so
I got
much
from
of
you.
What I've learned, I've gone my own direction since then, but I keep adding to it. Right?
Yeah. Well, I got it from you and you got it from Martin Armstrong and I got it from Martin Armstrong, but I got it from you first. So that goes with everything you just said with the bond market. So expect money to continually flow.
The money is flowing towards the U.S.
Yes.
I mean, and this is, you know,
I get
zero hedge, so a little bit of crap here and there, but actually for the most part, I still read zero hedge on a regular basis.
Me too.
It's still very, very good, even though there are days when I want to roll my eyes. Where zero hedge is, of course, at their best is when they do the postmortem on any U.S. Treasury auction. And I don't know about you, but I get the feed and I'm like, stellar 3-year auction, stellar 3-year auction, unprecedented 30-year auction. And I'm like, and then I'm looking at the rest of my Twitter feed, the U.S. is doomed. And I'm like,
Okay.
And I'm like, shut the fuck up.
Right. So tie this then into the dollar, meaning it seems like the dollar should be relatively stable and you don't see it going more. Much lower,
no,
and the dollar's
no.
relative to Look, everything else.
Yeah, I mean, Europe.
Hold on,
is putting
let me text this guy. Sorry,
I'm
going to be late.
Europe is putting up capital controls left and right. They're now threatening to fine Spaniards 150,000 euros for not announcing that, not telling the bank up front with a 30 days notice that they want to take out more than 3,500 euros.
Right.
Like that's one. There's all sorts of other ones that are going up. I'm hearing from people in, you know, in the banking industry, all, you know, I get little snippets here and there from people and they're like, oh yeah, they're locking down freaking capital hard in Europe. They know something's coming. And I'm telling you flat out, the Trump administration is putting all the financial pressure imaginable that they can on Europe. And I'm not saying that because I have like people in the know or I have sources. I won't do that. No, I'm right. telling you, this is my instinct, right? Mm-hmm. I can see it from the, when you put the panoply of policies, statements, moments, it, you know, all this little stuff. And again, some of what we do in this life is inductive reasoning. Mm-hmm. And we all want to be, we all, you know, we like to play on Twitter and whatnot using deductive reasoning. And deductive reasoning is very useful, but it's not wholly explanatory of everything. And I know autistes like to play in that world because they're not good at playing with inductive pattern recognition and instinct and everything else because they're left brain dominated autistes. That's like kind of the definition of being an autiste. And I get it. And I appreciate the utility of that at times. And then there are other times when you have to be able to just take a step back, look at everything and go, this is what I think is going on. And I'm going to make a call and I'm going to watch it play out. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to look for data points that can further confirm that in this kind of probability cloud of reality. Mm-hmm. You know, what I've been trying to do for 9 years, almost nine, well, 8 years now, is try to teach people how to do that. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. And yeah. requires you to take your ego and stuff it in the fucking corner somewhere.
100%.
Under a pillow or, you know, kill it with fire, whatever you have to do, because you're going to get your ass beat on a lot, on a great number of calls, because in order to be able to do that well, you have to dare to be wrong.
Yeah.
Really dare to be wrong.
You got to dare to be wrong and divorce your ego.
And then sit around and sweat and not sleep for 3 days because you just made the call. You just made a call that your entire business depends upon. And you're like, holy shit, now what? All right, well, this is where we're going. Are you sure? I think I can't tell you the number of times Extra White kind of looked at me with, you sure you're comfortable making that call? I'm like, no, but I'm making it anyway. Right. You know? And like, but you know, sometimes you have to trust your instincts. So what I'm telling you is that given everything that I've seen, everything we've talked about today, everything I've talked about in every other podcast I do and everything else, and you take the totality of it, I'm telling you, somebody in the Trump administration is pressing on the neck of the European financial markets, and they're doing it in conjunction with trying to stop the war in Ukraine, to stop the civil war in the United States, to stop all the things that we talked about today. It all comes back to that, because if you can, you know, they want to create a civil war here. Well, fuck you. We're going to create a financial crisis for you and we're going to take all your money. This is how we're going to beat you. Because again, go back to the game of Agricola. What's the goal? More points than you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Put them in the bucket. Invest them at 4%. Go build a pipeline. Like that's the metaphor and that's the reality. And, you know, in the game of geopolitics, you have to think like that. You have to think like a mob boss and you got to think like, you know, and you got to get rid of your morality, frankly, for a little while. And because there's no morality in geopolitics. Yeah. And that's very uncomfortable for a lot of people. What's wrong? Well, yeah, nope. Didn't say it wasn't.
Yeah, that's the way it is.
Didn't say it was.
You just got
to
play.
At the end of the day, the counter narrative is what they're doing to us isn't moral either. So then, what do? Is it defense? Are you playing defense? Or are you playing offense?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Are you? You know? And at what point do the two definitions blur? And then you have to ask yourself: then you get back to the maxim of geopolitics? There are no allies. There are only interests, and so everybody is acting in their best interest. You know, their thing. And it's not, and it doesn't matter whether you think it's moral or not. It doesn't matter. They're doing what they think is the right thing to do. Everyone's the hero of their own story, folks.
Mm-hmm.
And, yep. You know, I'm an American. And I know what story I tell myself when I go to bed. And I know what story that I know the story that they're telling themselves over in Europe and over in City London.
Yeah.
And fuck that story. I like my story. I'm sticking to it. It's my home. It's my community. It's my family. And I'm going to fight like a dog for it. And if you expect me to roll over and show you my belly, no, you get nothing but the teeth all day, every day. And that's the way Donald Trump is fighting. And some days he wins and some days he loses. Mm-hmm. And I believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the other thing. I have to believe it. And so do you.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, you know why? Because if you believe it, then it gives them the power to neutralize the Lindsey Grahams that you know are working against your best interest.
Yeah,
you
only absolutely
expect that Trump it doesn't have your best interest at heart, but you know that Lindsey Graham is a traitor. You know Chuck Schumer is a traitor. You know George Soros wants to destroy us. You know. And you have doubts, but those are more a reflection of you and your trust issues than anything else. Mm-hmm. All these people are a mirror. They're not a lens.
Yeah.
Charlie Kirk was a mirror. That's why they shot him.
Yep.
Because the mirror is a judge.
Yep. Well, Tom, you did it. You freaking did it. You tied it all together, man. And I didn't know what, Tom, we were going to get. I didn't know what I was going to be either, but you did it. So I thank you for that. Tom, how can people find you? How can they be a Patreon?
Sure. Patreon.com/GoldGoatsAndGuns. The newsletter is $12 a month or 15% off if you sign up annually, or $4 a month just for the twice weekly market reports. And, and then there's my Twitter feed, which I still refuse to call it X because it's just all wrong. It's still Twitter. The TFL1728 on Twitter, where the worst version of me will show up every day because I am in control of it. No, really. And there's my pattern. There's my thing. And the podcast is curated over TomLuongo.me. One of these days, I might actually write a new article for the blog. Christ, I don't have time.
Yeah, you're a busy guy. Well, I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you for spending time with me. And I'm also a confession. I am not a Patreon, but that is changing as soon as I get off this call with you. So I am the latest Patreon of Tom's. So to all my viewers and listeners, that's how much, and I rarely buy information, but I am happy to support Tom and I'm happy to buy your information. It's my pleasure to do that. So I want to thank you so much. I'll put all of this in the show notes, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
An honor, as always. Yep.
Take care.